You're listening to the JTD Coaches Me podcast with your host, Joanne Tierney Daniels. Tune in as Joanne chronicles her journey from imposter to empowerment. Joanne discusses real life with real people. You'll be captivated by her guests and their stories. Regardless of whether you leave laughing or crying, one thing is certain. Each episode will make you think about life from a different perspective. Listen in and join the journey as Joanne and her guests explore the best strategies to promote personal growth, find your authentic self, and live your best life.
Hi, I'm Joanne Tierney Daniels, a health and mindset coach and the host of the JTD Coaches Me podcast. Today, I'm going to be discussing forgiveness. It's a powerful concept. Letting go of our emotions, more specifically, our hatred, resentments, and bitterness, isn't an easy task. But negative emotions are like a virus. They pervade our system, infecting our spirits, robbing our joy, and limiting our potential. Forgiveness isn't about forgetting. It isn't about absolving criminals or condoning their offenses. Forgiveness is about reconciliation and release and taking your personal power back. It's an act of love to yourself. When we forgive, we can become complete again. Sometimes we must find the strength to forgive ourselves for our own personal culpability and our stories. You cannot love yourself if you hate any part of your story. And self-forgiveness is a call to stop reliving your trauma and re-victimizing yourself repeatedly. It's about discarding guilt and shame and growing through what you've gone through. Ultimately, it's about becoming the hero in your own story. My guest today, Marlise Hardiman, is a hero, but not only of her own story. Marlise is a sexual assault and trauma survivor, a teacher, life coach, and the founder and CEO of Transformation Speaks, a speaking organization dedicated to providing a voice to the voiceless and moving victims from tragedy to triumph. You will be shocked and amazed by her story, strength, and resiliency. It's an honor to have her here with us today. So please join me in welcoming Marlise to the conversation. Hi, Marlise. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, you're welcome. So let's jump right in. Your story is multifaceted. It's as heartbreaking as it is inspirational. Let's start from the beginning. Tell us about the first 10 years of your life, your mother's struggles, and the framework that set the stage for years of dysfunction.
I was born into a family where domestic violence was the norm. My father, not that he beat us, but he was known for honestly throwing my mother up under tables, tipping tables, being very angry, bitter, hitting, yelling, screaming. So I grew up in an environment where there was a lot of hostility, and you learn to shut your mouth and do what you were told. And that's what kept you safe. I can remember one day my father was going through his usual tantrum. My mom hadn't cooked the meal the way he wanted to. It wasn't hot enough. And when he went to the table, which was normal, we went through a lot of kitchen tables. He actually, by accident, caused one of the glass plates to hit my sister in the head. And I think that became the breaking point for my mother. She, for the first time, stood up for herself. She was angry. She was violent. She was screaming. She was yelling. And I think it took everybody in the house by surprise. And my father suddenly took the lesser role where he was like, I'm sorry, forgive me, you know, wasn't on purpose. But my mother was angry. And I think all of that anger that had been built up in her just poured out and she lost control. When they say she snapped, she snapped. And that night, I can remember her putting us in the car and pushing the car a block because she didn't want to start it because he would have, of course, came out and stopped it. But she pushed the car a block away from the home before she started it. And that was our great escape. And we moved to the town that was probably 2 hours away from her home. We moved with a friend of hers who had left earlier with her husband. We took one bag and what that could fit and my favorite toy. So I didn't have much to wear. I didn't have the things I was used to because we had grown up in a middle-class home and we instantaneously became impoverished. We lived in one room in our friend's home with her children. They were impoverished. My mom started going to a work program so that she could get a job because she had not worked. When I was a child, I never remember my mother worked. And I can safely say she probably didn't work the entire time she was married. So she had to gain skills in order to get employment. And everything, even though we were poor, went well for a while. We were at least safe. She was safe. But the thing that I remember most is she never smiled again. My mother was even though we had a violence going on, she was a happy person when she was around us. But when we moved away, she lost everything. And you could see the pressure, knowing my father could show up any moment and whisk us back to that violent environment, and the stress of not having weighed on her. And I can never remember her smiling until my 8th birthday. She announced, you know, we're going to have a birthday party, which was great because we didn't celebrate birthdays once we moved there. It was just like it passed like any other day. So she was like, you're going to have pizza. I'm going to give you a gift. And you can't invite anybody. It can only be the people who live in the house because we can't afford that. But we're going to play games. And she laughed and she smiled and my whole world was complete. So that day came, March the 25th, we're playing pin the tail on the donkey. I'm laughing. She's playing. I got my first outfit since we had moved away that was not hand-me-down because my sister got hand-me-down clothes from her daughter. And then I got my sister's clothes. So you can imagine by the time I got it, it was a little worse for the wear. But I got a gift from Kmart. It was a dress. It had ruffles. I can remember it. It was yellow. I got shoes and they were white. They were new. No one wore them. I was totally excited. You know, life couldn't have been better. I got a piece of pizza. Actually, I think it was 2 pieces of pizza that I didn't have to cut in half and give my sister some. It was just for me, got a can of pop. It was like, oh, life was great. One thing that we did in my mother's friend's home was that we had to be clean. That was the one thing. I don't care if you can't afford nice clothes, not clean clothes, but nice clothes. You were going to be clean. So my mother said, an hour or two before bedtime, you know, Lisa, you get to go first because usually I went last and it was always cold because everybody else took a bath. But she said, it's your birthday. Why don't you take a bath first? So again, I was excited. That meant hot water. So I went up to the bathroom and I started the water. And in all of my excitement and all of my joy, I forgot to latch the lock on the bathroom door. And it was that old-fashioned latch lock. So it wasn't like you pushed the lock in like today. You had to actually put the latch on. And that was also one of the house rules, that you always go in the bathroom and latch the lock because so many people live there. You know, you didn't want anybody walking in on you. And I could hear someone pulling on the door. And I didn't have any clothes on at this point because I'm getting ready to get in a bath. And so I noticed the latch was off and I was like, I yelled out there, wait a minute, I'm in here. And I could still feel someone messing with the door. So I went to put the latch on And when I did that, the door flung open. I fell between the tub and the toilet. And it was Earl. And I just lay there. I don't know. I should have screamed. Something should have said, scream. But you either fight, flight, or freeze. And I froze. And as I just kind of like lay there, he, with no clothes on, he sexually assaulted me. And all I could remember was tears running down my eyes and the smell of urine, because my head is between the tub and the toilet. When he got finished, he said, now you have a real birthday gift. And if you say anything, I'll call your dad. And he'll come and take you away and you'll never see your mom again. And because I believed him, I kept my mouth shut. I didn't tell my mom. Because I shared a bed with my mother and my sister, you would have thought she would have known. Because I cried, I didn't get in the tub. I just washed myself off, wrapped up toilet paper and because I'm literally bleeding, and put toilet paper in my little panties, and I went to bed. And I lay there, and I didn't cry. I moaned and just moaned. And my mother came in, and she looked at me, and then she laid down. She never said a word the entire night. And when I remember when she got up, I felt her and she looked at me and she walked away. And later I realized as I went through the healing process that she had traded me. She probably knew what had happened and she traded my safety for her safety. And I don't blame her. I'm not mad at her because I understand she was thinking out of victim's mindset. She was just as much a victim as I was. And that scarring causes something. You don't think straight. You think, I got to stay away. I can help her later on. She'll be all right. He continued to sexually assault me. And I could hear conversations at night, screaming and hollering between him and his wife. And I would hear my name come up. So I knew what it was about. But he didn't stop. And eventually the arguing stopped. And the moment I stopped hearing them arguing was the moment that his wife started changing towards me. For example, if I was the last one in, now again, I'm at least 8, so everybody else is older than me, so they can move faster than me. If I was the last one in to wash my hands during lunch, I didn't get lunch. She would tell me, since you can't hurry up and you're acting like a dog, I'll treat you like a dog. And I would literally have to eat the scraps off everybody's plate. I would have to stand and watch everyone eat and what they had left on the plate when they were finished. I would get, she wouldn't make me a plate. She wouldn't give me a sandwich. She would be like, now you can eat like the dogs do. And again, not understanding, now I'm traumatized, not only sexually, but emotionally, mentally. So I never told my mom. I never, because I don't know. Because victims don't tell. And I got that. Victims don't tell. So she would, if our room or the area I was playing in the house wasn't picked up and I walked away from it, she would make me sit behind the couch in a hind catcher position for hours. Tears running down my eyes. She would stuff a rag in my mouth because she would tell me, Children are to be seen and not heard. So I don't want to hear you. I can remember on several occasions vomiting in my mouth and having to swallow it because there was something blocking it getting out. So that is my experience till I was about 10 years old and my mother finally got a job. And I knew she knew then because we moved as soon as she got paid. It was like, oh, I got paid. Let's go. And we moved in the house that was across town as far as she could get from them. We didn't go back for Christmas, no birthdays, no trick or treat, Halloween, nothing. So I knew at that moment that was her attempt to rescue me from all that I had gone through. But it was too late. I mean, being honest, the damage was done. So that was my early childhood, all balled up and looking nasty.
So I know your story and I still get choked up hearing it every time. I can feel your joy and see you in that yellow dress and just how happy you were. And then to go to that drama, you know, as a mother and just as a human, it's heartbreaking. So thank you for sharing that. And thankfully the abuse ended when your mother finally left that environment, but you must have carried that trauma with you. You know, you were sexually assaulted, you endured extreme cruelty and punishments at the hand of your perpetrator's life. I mean, what did your life look like after you left? What impact did that trauma have on your psyche and behavior until, you know, we're going to talk about what happened later in your life, but up until that point, how were you handling it as an 8-year-old girl until you were 16?
Thankfully, not only during the time I was being abused, but after it, there were what I want to call angels who kind of stepped in and gave me love and affection. And even though they didn't remove me from the situation, they gave me a break from the situation, enough time for me to just realign myself and tell myself, you know, it's going to be okay. It's going to be okay. One of them was my third grade teacher. Because of the abuse, I developed neurological disorders. Because again, I told you I froze. So that became my motive, what I did, whether it was a sexual assault or a spelling test. Literally, my body would freeze from the tip of my toes all the way up to the crown of my head. My tongue, my eyes, everything would freeze. And my third grade teacher was giving our first spelling test. You know, when you review the words you were supposed to learn in second grade that I didn't learn because I was a horrible speller. She saw me freeze. I was holding the pencil and all of a sudden I couldn't write. And all that I could do was cry. All that would come out was tears. She walked to me without saying a word and without stopping, took the pencil out of my hand, flattened my hand, and started rubbing my back and whispered, "It'll be okay. It'll be okay. We'll do this later." And I was like, wow. And this woman would stay in for Reese with me the time that she should have been on break as a teacher. And she stayed with me and would give me the spelling test. And she would rub my hands and rub my back. And if I looked like I was even getting fearful, she would tell me, "Don't worry." Because Benjamin Franklin always said there's two ways to spell every word. So I was like, okay, two ways, it didn't matter. She would take me to the Goodwill and buy me clothes to wear, and you know, Goodwill to me at that point is like, no. She would take me home and buy me ice cream. I spent weekends with her sometimes just to give me that break. And her mother, she didn't live with her husband. She lived with her mother. So they spoiled me and braided my hair and taught me, you know, you're a wonderful person. I know. And they never brought up the abuse, never asked me what's happening at home. They just loved me right where I was. And I really believe that gave me the strength to make it. Then when we moved away, I met Veronica. Oh my gosh. Veronica was my best friend. And she never asked me what happened, but I would go to her house and it was like, I learned what families were supposed to be like. We played, we ate. We had a club and her mother made us jackets that said pink and pink something, ever pink. And it wasn't an expensive jacket, but they bought this jacket and she fixed it up. And, you know, it was a club of just her and me. And that time between my next trauma and my first trauma was a healing time. It was a time when I got to learn what it meant to be a kid. It was, I consider life like a tapestry, and it was Black. And between Miss Black and my godfather, they brought all these wonderful, beautiful colors to my life that allowed me to heal without ever explaining to them what had happened. So I took the pain and locked it away and became a kid. My mother laughed and smiled and giggled, and my sister and I fought like sisters are supposed to fight, you know, not fist fights, but arguments and yelling. And mom was always there saying, you guys calm down. You guys don't be mean to each other. So it was good. It was a good experience.
So thank God.
So I can't complain about that part of my life. I think it allowed me to get the strength I needed to endure the next phase.
It's hard to imagine. I mean, you bring up the next phase, but the worst was yet to come in some respects. I mean, tell us what happened to you when you were 16.
Okay. When I was 16, my mother convinced me again, I think there might have been something wrong with her senses on what kind of people are okay. She convinced me to do some daycare or babysitting for her friend because it was her birthday and her husband wanted to take her out and wine and dine her. So reluctantly, because of my first experience, I went because I didn't like to be alone. I didn't like to be away from my home because that was like my safe place now. So I went to do the daycare, and initially everything was fine. The kids were kids, and, you know, I fed them pizza. We did what you do, watch TV with them. So it was a very normal experience. However, once the kids were asleep, I went and laid on the couch. I didn't change clothes, didn't have pajamas on. I was very conservative because of my original experience. So my belly wasn't showing, nothing revealing. You know, I had a t-shirt on, it was summer, but it was an appropriate t-shirt, covered everything. And I heard around 11 or 12 o'clock, I heard them, and I'm assuming it was about 12, I heard them coming in, and I knew I heard her come in because she was singing and laughing, and you could tell that she was drunk. And she went upstairs. Well, when she went upstairs, her husband came in after she did. And he came and sat in the recliner in the living room. And the hairs on the back of my head began to stand up. I had never met this man before, other than She introduced him when I got there that, you know, this was her husband. And I knew her, but I didn't know him. And I felt my hair stand up. So immediately I began to tell myself, stay away, stay away, stay away. Don't go to sleep. He never said anything to me. He turned on TV, started watching television. And I began trying to stay awake. So eventually I fell asleep. And when I woke up to feeling a breeze and trying to get up. And I looked and I saw my clothes were sitting on the floor across from the couch where I was. So I tried to get up and get them. And I felt pressure, and half asleep, I wasn't sure what was going on. So I felt pressure and I started to panic because I couldn't move from the waist down. And finally, I came to realize that there was someone who was straddled across me. And as I regained consciousness, I could see the outline of the figure because now the television's off and it's dark. I recognized his figure. Again, I didn't scream. I should scream. Oh my God, I should scream. I didn't scream. I didn't yell. I felt that old familiar friend creeping up my legs. I was going numb. I was scared. As I did open my mouth, I felt a wad of paper go into my mouth. And all of a sudden, all I could do was cry. And he sexually assaulted me in the worst kind of way. He left me bruised. He left blood. I mean, I was shattered. And he just finished what he did, what he was going to do. He got up, he went upstairs, and I was left laying in a pool of blood once again, my body racking in pain. This was worse than anything I had felt as a child. I finally regained enough strength to literally, I couldn't even stand. I rolled off the couch onto the floor and I crawled into the bathroom that was downstairs. Once I got in the bathroom, I can remember kicking the door closed and I took what was in my mouth out and it was a $20 bill. So in my mind, he was telling me I was worth $20. And I can remember just balling up in a ball and crying. The pain, not only the physical pain, but the mental pain that I was experiencing was unbelievable. At that moment, darkness just came in, and that's all I felt. I slowly wiped myself down and hid the toilet paper and the rags that I had used, tried to clean them the best I could, and then hid them in the bottom of the trash container. I crawled back out, took a rag, and wiped off the couch where he had assaulted me. And I didn't get back on the couch. I balled up in a fetal position. And I laid on the floor and cried as waves of anger and pain and shame just rolled over me. I didn't get any sleep that night. I just cried. I can remember crying until I heard her coming down the steps. And I just said, I want to go home. Take me home now. Just take me home. Not wanting to, again, learning. You shut your mouth. You don't say anything. So I didn't tell her. I just said, take me home because I didn't want to get into you're lying. He didn't do that. His word against my word and risking her not believing me. So she took me home. I went into the house. I got a butcher knife. I'll never forget this. And put it under my pillow. And I went to sleep. And I slept with a butcher knife under my pillow until I left my mother's home. I started engaging in truly self-destructive, anything that you can think of. I tried to kill myself. I was drinking, I was smoking. I was promiscuous because I didn't feel like I was worth anything. Veronica, who was my best friend, we still lived in the same place. She still lived in the same place. I cut all ties with her because she was the old me, the better me, the better version of me. And I felt like I couldn't talk to her. I couldn't tell her what I was going through. I started hanging out with kids that you wouldn't want your kid hanging out with. No one would want the kid to hang out with. Even the kids, parents that have those kids, don't want their kid to hang out with each other. Skipping school, it was a very horrible experience. I got pregnant my junior year from a guy who was very abusive. And the reason why was he was also the person who was selling me the drugs. And you trade favors. Sounds horrible, but that's where I was. I did meet again an angel. It seems like God sends people just, you know, when you really need them. Who, Mr. Freilich, he was my government teacher my senior year. And he never said, "You're skipping school," because he knew I was skipping. But he would say, like, "You know what? If you would come to school, if you could just show up, you would be so wonderful. You know, you're smart." And he would just always feed me positives, even though I didn't want to hear it. And probably 2 months before I graduated, he said, "You know, you need to go to college. We need to get you out of Springfield." And he said, "I'm going to help you find a school." So on his own time and on his own dime, he started going through the process of trying to find a school where a young mother could attend and not leave her kids, because he knew, even though I was crazy, that child was in the good thing that I had, in my opinion, in my life. So I wasn't, you know, about to leave him with my mom, or because all of those old feelings are coming up. Is she going to protect? So I need to make sure. So he found a college that was about 20 minutes away that had started a parenting, a young mother or a young parents program. So you could go to school and they had apartments that you could move into, and they helped you get daycare. They were working with children's services to provide daycare while you were in school. They helped you get transportation. They supplemented everything you needed. They helped you get food stamps. And I mean, I know, you know, some people might think, you know, that's horrible, but that's what it's there for. It's there for people who are trying to better themselves. So even angry, even bitter, even not making wise choices, I knew at least I needed to get out of the situation I was in. So I went to school. I met my husband there, who is now my husband. He was
Marlise, before we get too much further into your story, I want to just bring up one point about, and I think it's an important point, or I wouldn't interrupt here, but while I was listening to your story, I think that no matter how far somebody comes, as you were describing it, you know, you were speaking about what you were wearing that night. And even now you still hold, you know, it's just tough to break free from that, because of course, regardless of what you were wearing, it wouldn't have mattered. And I think that, you know, it's important to remind victims that you can wear whatever you want. Nobody has the right to harm you in any way because of what you're wearing. And I think that for you, I watch you as you're classifying it, and you're just still holding on to just a little bit. And I think that that's such a poignant part of your story. And I think too, when you're speaking about, you know, you should have screamed. I think everybody has the right to respond in their own response. And, right. You know, you don't have, you, there's nothing that dictates that you have to scream. And I think that that's still, you know, we blame ourselves for so many things. And I think that for myself, I've carried guilt and shame for a lifetime. And I just want to point out that we certainly shouldn't be carrying, nobody should carry the sins of somebody else or the guilt or shame, because you were a child, you were innocent. And I love your story, and you fast forwarded to college, but you know, I just wanted, and I love all of it. I know your story, but I want you to talk a little bit more about your teachers and what inspired you to pursue the path that you did in college. I want to make sure that they get their just due, because they were such saviors and heroes in your story. And I think that I love that teacher. I love your senior teacher. And I want you to tell them a little bit about what inspired you to become a teacher and how instrumental those angels were in your life, as you described them and the path that you took in college.
Mr. Frelick, and you are true. I mean, he's passed, but every time I think about him, he like grabbed me right at the right time. He had a process. He was not like the nice, kind, sweet teacher that people would think about. Oh, he was rough. He was like rigid. He like had a regimen. Monday, I give you notes. Tuesday, I lecture over the notes. Wednesday, we review the notes. Thursday, I give you a pre-test. Friday, I give you a test. And that was the process. There was never, you know, like, let's watch a movie. You know, that was not him. You know, that was not him. But because he did that, I knew where I could mess up. I knew I had to be on class on Monday because I needed those notes. I didn't like to hear him lecture because he was dry and long-winded like I But I knew that I didn't have to show up on Tuesday and Wednesday. If I wasn't sure what I got on Monday, I could always show up on Thursday. And the test was on Friday, and I had to be there for the test. So he taught me how to like regulate myself, that even in my craziness, that you have to regulate your craziness. You can't just let it take over your life. And that was, he taught me that. And he also, even though he was rough and kind of hard around the corners, he never blamed me like, you're skipping school and blah, blah, blah. He let the people who were responsible for handling my attendance handle my attendance. And he kept saying, it's nice that you attended school today. It's nice that you came to class. I'm glad to see you. So it made me feel like I was important, that my presence meant something, because he took the time to notice when I was there and when I wasn't. And he would always encourage me, like, I take the test, and when he gave me my test back, he would be like, you know why you missed that question? It was because you weren't in the lecture, and you might needed to hear that. So it wasn't anger. It was like, yeah, you're smart. You just missed this because you missed the information. So he never made me feel bad about missing it, but that I could do better if I would try harder, apply myself more. And that helped. He also invested in me in a time when I wasn't investing in myself. He took the time. I didn't look for the college. I was just nodding my head when he said, you need to go to college. I was like, oh, yeah, sure. But I really didn't believe that I was going to college. Well, he took the time to find the college, make the contacts, find someone to help me fill out the financial aid. He even bought a lot of the stuff that I needed to furnish that apartment so I wouldn't just go in there and not have any dishes and not have any bedspreads. And I don't know where he got all this stuff. He could have went to Goodwill. It didn't matter. He thought about me enough to provide for me. And I'm a teacher. That's why I do what I do. I teach history. And actually, the first job that I got, I was a government teacher for freshmen. I left freshmen because that was my pain point. But I taught government and I teach history because that's what he taught. And he, it's no better way for me to honor him, but to do what he did for me and kind of play it forward to the next generation.
So that's one of my favorite parts of your story, particularly now in this COVID age when there are so many teachers who are heroes. I mean, not all of them can compare to your government teacher, but, you know, I just love that part of your vocation. I love highlighting teachers today because they really are all stepping up and doing things that are outside of the realm of their normal duties. And so I just wanted to give him his due and yours as the fact that you went into the same profession and you have the same care and concern about your students as he did. So I love that part of your story. And, you know, you went through college and I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about that and what you went through. And you had another savior and that was your advisor in college. And tell us a little bit about that.
College was fun. I mean, because you could do a lot in college and people kind of close their eyes to it because they say it's college. They're experimenting. So even though I had my son, I took care of him, but I had a lot of help. I can even remember, I have to be honest, my first Christmas, I didn't have any money. My mom didn't have any extra money. This in the human services department, they all got together and they bought my son Christmas. And me Christmas, you know, because they had access into my room, into my mini apartment. They decorated a tree. So when I came back from class and I had him with me, we were all both amazed, like, where'd this come from? Who did this? There must really be a Santa Claus. The college was remarkable. I mean, they were caring people. My advisor, once I got to my junior year, said, okay, what are you going to do? And at that point, he said, you can't stay here forever. You're supposed to go for 4 years and then leave. I said, you haven't failed any classes. You're going to leave. What are you going to leave with? And when I told him that I wanted to be a teacher, because it wasn't like I sat down and thought about it. It was like, it was the first thing on my mind. Oh, I want to be a teacher. He said very honestly and very pointedly, then you need to stop some of the behaviors that you're doing because they're going to drug test you. And if you are dirty, you can kiss your teaching career down the tubes. You went to school for 4 years for nothing because no one will hire you if your urine is dirty. It was like an aha moment. I got to do something about this. And even though at this point, I don't trust anybody, so I'm not going to therapy. I'm not going to go anywhere. And I had my boyfriend, and thank God for Jeff, because he was a white knight. I mean, he didn't drink, he didn't smoke, he didn't cuss. He's very straightforward, very clean cut. And he would like take me to parties and then say, don't touch her. Let her dance, let her do whatever she's going to do. And then I'm taking her home just like I brought her. So don't get it twisted, as he would say. So I used him as my beginning of my healing process. I started talking to him. When I told him about my childhood, he never ran. When I said, okay, I got at least can't do drugs. I came home and told him, and I can't say it was my home, not his home. I can't do drugs anymore, and I'm going to need your help. I can't drink. I can't smoke. I can't pop pills. So we're going, and I just went through the house, like putting stuff in the trash can. Can't do this, can't do that. And he was there to help me navigate that time because I was still crazy. I was still mean. I was still very much unbearable. But at least I knew that this had to stop in order for me to be able to teach. And he walked through that process with me and he endured some tough stuff. Because when you are taking drugs to get up and then taking drugs to go to sleep, and then all of a sudden you stop, you tend to be very mean, very abusive. He dealt with that in order to help me become who I am today. So I have to give him his props too, because mm-hmm. I was mean, just awful. When I did finally get the first teaching job, it was like that aha moment. And things started clicking all together at once because I was like, okay, you got to get clean. And at the same time, he was like, I had gotten married and he had said, you know, Lisa, I can't deal with you anymore. You're just too much. You really are too much. And so Black African-Americans, culturally, do not go to therapy. They go to church. So his answer was, we're going to go to church. And I met a wonderful pastor who looked at me and saw my pain and never exposed it, but said, let me help you. So we start a 12-step program. That is a wonderful process. I mean, we started reading books about forgiveness. We started talking and working it. I give it to him. He took, because it was here. It was in my gut. And as it came up, it wasn't pretty. It wasn't nice to look at. It wasn't nice to hear. But he heard it. I screamed at him. I yelled at him. I called him names. Everything that went wrong in my life, it was automatically his fault, because you got to blame somebody. You got to blame God. You got to blame. And he took all that and he never said, go away. Don't talk to me. He just loved me with an unconditional love that he didn't have to show me. And helped me get through it and began to heal. And it sort of was a rapid healing because I was giving to kids. So I was teaching. And that was healing because it wasn't just the content that I was teaching. I was doing for them what I wish that my angels had done for me, but that I wish more people understood. And that's why I train teachers on how to work with people who are traumatized, because I began to do that in action. I began to read books that talked about how to become trauma-informed. And I was helping them, and it was helping me help me. So all that stuff was happening all at the same time. It was like a big boom. All of a sudden, I was learning to hear the music in my heart all by myself and learning how to dance to it. And it was exciting. I was just, wow.
So before we get to go down too further, I do want to talk about forgiveness for a minute, because we said we were going to do that. So I know that you have spoken about forgiveness and the role it played in your healing process. What did that entail, and who did you feel you needed to forgive to move forward?
The biggest part of that, during that process, the man who had assaulted me the second time was dying of cancer. And I don't know how it happened. His daughter contacted me because I think I was the only person that she knew that went to church. And she asked me, would I come to the hospital and pray for her dad? And I was like, oh, no, I'll kill him. I helped him along that journey, you know. And I did a lot of soul searching with my pastor and with my husband. And they were all like, go, go. It's going to help. For that reason, for the reason that you can forgive. But, you know, when they say there's an angel and a devil sitting on your shoulder. So the angel was like, go, be kind, forgive, let it go. And the devil was like, girl, you better choke that man out. So I found myself in the hospital room, angry, confused, crying, she not knowing what's going on because no one had ever told her. I never told her. And her trying to figure out, why is this woman crying? All I did was ask her to come and pray. So when I looked down at him, he had all these wires and tubes and going in and out of him and bells and whistles. I just looked at him and I really wanted to take the pillow and choke him out. Just kill him. I just felt like I would feel better if I killed him, if he died at my hands. There was a part of me that knew that was wrong. And I wasn't going to pray. I started to walk away. And I remember he grabbed my arm. And I don't know if it was his strength or my mental psyche just losing it. But it was like the strength of 1,000 men. And he pulled me and he pulled me down to him. And he said, I'm sorry. And I cried and he cried. And it was like time stood still. And as I looked at this man, really looked at him, he was a shell of the man who had assaulted me. And I was happy. And he was dying. And I began to cry. And in that moment, I forgave him. Because I understood, and I think I always knew this, that there had been something that happened to him that made him abuse me. Because hurting people hurt people. Mm-hmm. And if I was going to really stop the legacy of him hurting me and me hurting other people, I had to forgive him. I had to let it go. I had to cut the connection between him and me. And that by praying for him and putting him in God's hands, that I would be suffering the tie. And I could live on and let him live or go through whatever he had to go through and know that justice would be served whether I saw it or not. And I prayed for him. And I ran out of that room after I prayed. I didn't say goodbye to her, didn't say goodbye to him. And I got in my car and all that junk, all that residue stuff that was still there that I thought I had worked through just came flooding up in me. And I cried and I screamed and I yelled and I beat the steering wheel. And I'm sure the people who were parked beside me thought, this woman is crazy. Because I needed to like just forgive, to truly let it go, because that's really what forgiveness is about. It's about cutting the tie, letting it go. And I didn't just need to let it go with him. I needed to let go with the first abuser, and I needed to let go with his wife, and I needed to let them go, knowing that they would never say I'm sorry, because he was dead at that point. So was she. But I needed to let them go because I needed to let go, to just forgive. And I cried because it hurts. Forgiveness hurts. Don't let anybody who thinks and who tells you, I'll just forgive, you'll be okay. No, it hurts. It hurts to your very soul. But when it happens, it releases all the clutter and it organizes your heart so that you can hear you. And until I could do it, I stayed right there in that car. I didn't move. And until I had cried, until I couldn't cry anymore, and my eyes burned. And then as I drove home, I felt lighter. I felt better until I got to my own home and I felt free, because that's what forgiveness does for you. It frees you. It frees you from everybody and everything that ever held you captive. All the shackles that were around your legs that kept you from moving forward. It said, you're free. Go. Go in peace. Go and learn and be. So that is my experience with forgiveness. And now I try to give it quickly. When they say, don't let the sun go down on your anger, I truly do not let the sun go down on my anger toward anybody, whether they ask me for forgiveness or not. I offer it to them. I say their name and say, I forgive you. You didn't know. You might not have known you hurt me, or that what you did was a stumbling block for me. And that way I keep my heart always playing the music so I can dance to it. And that's what forgiveness is. It's turning up the music of your own heart.
I love that. I recently listened to another interview and I wanted to get your perspective on this. It was one woman, and she was interviewing another rape victim. And the young woman being interviewed stated that she had forgiven her perpetrator. And then the interviewer, who herself was a victim of sexual assault in her teens, asked why she had forgiven him. She indicated that instead of offering forgiveness, perhaps he should be thanked for his role in making the victim the person who she is today. And that's what she did for her perpetrator. She said that he should be offered love and gratitude. I think that's an interesting perspective and one that many victims would find tough to grasp. I mean, what's your perspective on that?
I would agree 100%, because who I am today, I would have never became without the trauma. The trauma is my platform. And in a way, I would have never had the platform without him. I have to be honest and say I could have lived without it. But I still have to say thank you, because I was able to move beyond it. So I don't know that he deserves the gratitude as much as all of the people who engaged in my life because of the experience I had with him. I think they deserve the gratitude, but I think he deserves my understanding that he didn't none of them did anything to me that hadn't probably been done to them in some form. And so I need to extend their understanding for that and to wish them peace, but to thank the people who engaged with me despite the things I said and did, and honor them and say, you know, I appreciate you. Miss Black actually was a counselor at the first school I got hired at. And when I went into her office, we shut the door and we just cried. She held me, and I'm grown. She held me. It was my first day in her last year. Well, my first year, her last year. And we just cried and cried and cried because she got to see what she did. And I got to be thankful for what she did. And I mean, I brought her lunch. I did everything that I could do to make her life easier. Because when I needed her, she was there and she could have turned away. So I think they deserve the thank you and he deserves the understanding.
I love that perspective. For me, I'm more aligned to your perspective. I understand both of them, but you know, your trauma, and I don't minimize anybody's trauma, but you certainly lived a very traumatic life, and that perspective resonates with me. I mean, what's your advice on how other trauma survivors can overcome their inner demons and find a path to recovery if they're not quite through their healing process?
First, find someone who will hold space for you so that you can tell your story. And not someone who, okay, that's mom and I should tell mom because she's related to me. I mean, someone who is not going to question what you tell them because that will do more harm than it does good. But someone who will just listen and be empathetic. Not sympathetic from the top of the mountain and say, oh, you poor thing, but someone who will say, I've hurt, maybe not like you've hurt, but thank you for sharing with me. Find someone that you can talk to or start journaling your feelings about the experience. Get it out of you. It's kind of like a Band-Aid. As long as you keep the bandage on, you will never heal. You have to expose your pain to some light and some air so that you can heal. So the first thing I always advise is whether it's a therapist, whether it is a close friend who you trust, find someone who you can expose your pain to, because the moment you expose it is the moment you begin healing.
I love it. So tell us more about Transformation Speaks and what your mission is today to help others who have been victimized.
Transformation Speaks. My goal is to eradicate sexual assault, or at least help those people who have experienced it to live a healing, fulfilled life where they can dance in the rain. Because it's going to rain. We're all going to experience some rain, some trauma. But when we learn to dance in it, is the moment that we're free from it. So I speak to women and men who have experienced sexual assault, domestic violence, and encourage them through storytelling how they can forgive and move forward. I also train teachers, community leaders, how to recognize people who have experienced trauma. And since we've been COVID-19, we are all traumatized. So we all need some healing and how to create an environment where people can heal. Because there are certain things that you can do that make healing easier or harder. And I try to help them identify it and how to create systems that encourage self-care. Because I don't care what your job is, you need to take care of yourself. And you can promote that from an organizational standpoint. So it's not just an individual working as hard as they can you need to allow people who work for you to set limits so that they can worry about their own mental health. So those are my two goals. And I work with people actually who have assaulted people, which was a unique experience. I went into prison and talked to men who have been accused or are in prison because of sexual assault and explain to them, do you know what you've done? And giving them the voice of the victim, because many of them never take the time to understand, I hurt somebody and I've altered their life. So I give them that opportunity, hoping that it will give them the chance to sit down and look at their own pain before they hurt someone else.
You're amazing, and I can't tell you how impressed and in awe I am of you. I'm almost to my final question. I hate to let you go before I ask it, is there anything else that you want to speak to the listeners about and or anything that we missed or we haven't covered?
I'm in a process of writing a book with all these like life-changing principles, and I'm giving tidbits of my story in it. I'm plugging the book, not for money's sake, but if you can't talk to anybody, that process, that book is going to give you an opportunity to look at the trauma in your eyes through the trauma that I went through, and at least give you an opportunity to have activities that are going to force you to look at yourself. And it gives you activities that you can do on your own and work through. It is not the answer. It's a supplement. And sometimes you take a supplement until you get what you need to really heal. I just want people to be whole and to be healed.
I love that. So as we've discussed, you know, we've spoken about it, and I can't say it enough times, your story is traumatic, empowering, and inspirational all at the same time. And we've spoken about some harsh realities here today. And I want to end on a high note. You know, we've spoken about how horrific your childhood was, but tell us what the happiest moment of your childhood was or your life, and how we can celebrate that.
The happiest moment? I've never... You know what, honestly, the happiest moment of my life, Veronica and I went to a birthday party, and I had never been to a birthday party, and the young man's parents rented out the movie theater, and we watched Purple Rain. I love Purple Rain to this day. I know every song Prince sings by heart, and it was fun and thrilling. And I agree with you, even though there's a lot of trauma in life, if you can celebrate the good times, remember the good times, stand on the good times, it makes the bad times bearable. And honestly, I love, to this day, I go right back into being this 14-year-old kid singing Purple Rain. I mean, every time I hear it,
I love,
you know, that. Yes, that was definitely, as a child or as a teenager, that moment that resonates in my heart. And it's music, and I love music.
So now, instead of dancing in the rain, I'm always going to envision you dancing in the purple rain. That's my new motto for you, or my new vision of you. And I love it. And you know what? I love Purple Rain too. And I can sing every Prince song in that too. We'll have to do a duet on the next interview.
Yes.
We'll talk about your book. We'll do a little singing, a little karaoke. So before I let you go, I can't thank you enough for being here. It was an honor and a privilege. Please tell the listeners where they can learn more about you, more about Transformation Speaks, and where they can reach out to you directly.
Okay. I have a website called transformationspeaks.com. There's a page, And there is a page that links directly to my email. So if you leave me a note, I will respond. I respond to everybody. I have an email. If you want to email me directly, it's transformationspeaks@yahoo.com. If you want to connect with me on Instagram, it's transformationspeaks1. If you want to connect with me on Facebook, it's transformationspeaks or servant leader Marlise Hardiman. And I forgot, if you want to connect with me on LinkedIn, it's Marlise Hardiman. It's under my name. I'm open if you need help and you just want someone to talk to. I listen. I'm a good listener and I keep my mouth shut and I don't judge. So if you just want to talk, I will listen. If you want help to work through the process, I'm not a therapist, but I will listen and guide you with what I know. If you need a therapist, I will say, you need to go for you. And I will help you find a therapist and I will not leave you or abandon you because I know the power of connectedness.
I love it. So thanks so much for being here. And I can't wait to read the book. And I'll have you back if you're willing. You'll be a big star by then. And I don't know if you'll have time for us, but.
I don't need to be a star. I just need to help. I need you as much as you need me because you have a platform that allows me to reach people. So I definitely will be back. I will never be too busy.
Great. And I'm going to end it by saying you already are a star. So you're already in that realm. So thanks so much. And I'll talk to you soon.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the JTD Coaches Me podcast. You can find additional resources and information about Joanne at jtdcoachesme.com. Please make sure to subscribe to this podcast for updates and new episodes. You can also follow Joanne on social media under JTD Coaches Me.